Welcome to the Eurospace Hub special episode from the podcast Business of Collaboration. Eurospace Hub aims to digitally connect the space ecosystem in Europe. From tech transfer offices to industry, space accelerator networks, research centers, and other universities, Eurospace Hub will allow these actors to easily connect with financial opportunities, from the Horizon Europe framework to space research, space technology, and to accelerator programs. Eurospace Hub will bridge the gap between academic institutions and industry using a collaborative ecosystem and entrepreneurial mindset inside the universities and beyond. Every month, with the Eurospace Hub special episodes, we want to share stories about space technology and research with you. Enjoy the conversation.
Today, your host is Jara Pascual, founder and CEO of Collab with. Our guest is Professor Roger Davies from Oxford University. Professor Roger Davies is a British astronomer and cosmologist who discovered an apparent concentration of mass in the universe called the Great Attractor. He's a professor of astrophysics at Oxford University in the UK. His research interest is on cosmology and how galaxies form and evolve. He has pioneered the use of new class of astronomical spectrograph to measure the masses and ages of galaxies, as well as research for black holes in the nucleus. He is the founding director of the Oxford Center for Astrophysical Studies. In this podcast, Professor Davies is discussing how he was feeling after he discovered an apparent concentration of mass in the universe, the Great Attractor. And as well, Professor Davies will discuss why are space missions so important and how many different disciplines are involved in one mission. Enjoy the conversation. Welcome, Professor Roger Davies, to the podcast Business of Collaboration with the special edition of Eurospace Hub.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Professor Davies, you are Professor of Astrophysics in the University of Oxford.
That's right.
What is your story about becoming an astronomer cosmologist?
Okay, so I've been interested in astronomy since I was a little boy. But of course, that's a different matter from becoming a professional astronomer. You know, my parents were kind enough to buy me a telescope and all that kind of thing, and I spent cold nights out in the garden using my telescope. But it was obviously much later when I was at school and realized I had a bit of an aptitude for maths and physics and science generally. And then I went to University College London to read physics. And when I finished my degree, I had the opportunity to do a PhD. And I thought, well, if I don't take this now, then I will never take this opportunity. So I took the opportunity to do a PhD in astronomy at Cambridge, and that led me to be a researcher and then on to be a university professor.
You have discovered, when you were doing a postdoc, an apparent concentration of mass in the universe called the Great Attractor. So how do you come to this conclusion? And I think very important, how was your feeling with the discovery?
Yes. Okay. So, yes, well, the Great Attractor was a story, really, a big story, because in the late 1980s, when we reported the results, these were quite unexpected and therefore a little bit revolutionary. And so I should backtrack a little bit and tell you what we did and how it led to this discovery. So, as you know, the universe is expanding, and that's one of the principal ways, the Hubble law, that we use to measure the distances to galaxies, because the distance to a galaxy is proportional to its recession velocity. However, the local universe nearby can induce motions, the masses in the local universe can induce motions on galaxies over and above the Hubble expansion. And The only way to measure this is to have an independent way to determine the distance to the galaxies from the Hubble motion. So if you have an independent way to determine the distance, then you can determine both the actual distance and the distance implied by the Hubble motion. And those two things are not the same because galaxies have a small additional motion superimposed on them because they're near a big mass. So if you do this across the sky with lots and lots of galaxies, we used about 400 galaxies, you can start to see the patterns in the sky that arise from mass concentrations, which you can't see. And this is the standard way in which astronomers measure masses. They look for motions that are induced by those masses. And so we worked all this out and discovered that there was a lot more mass in the direction of the Hydra and Centaurus constellations than had been seen in the galaxies themselves. And we suggested that this was a concentration of clusters, a big dark mass hidden mostly behind the plane of the Milky Way that had not been seen before. But the mass was so great that it wasn't really in accordance with what was expected from the cosmology of the time. And so this caused a bit of commotion in the world of cosmology. And that was only really resolved when people were able to accommodate these large motions by altering the cosmological model. So it was a driving force behind a new method of being able to determine the distribution of mass in the universe. How did I feel about it? Well, it was exciting. It's always exciting to be associated with a discovery. But of course, there's also a sense that, well, are we absolutely sure this is right? And you have to check everything. So when you think you've discovered something out of the ordinary, of course, you know it's not expected. You know it's not what is in current agreement with theoretical models. And so you have to check every single calibration analysis that you've done in order to be sure that, you know, you are actually measuring a real effect and not something which is an artifact. And when you report these results, you know, these results typically get reported at scientific conferences before they're written in papers. You always have this sinking feeling that somebody's going to ask a question which reveals the flaw in your argument. You know, this is the problem of the emperor's clothes, right? Somebody asks a question and the emperor is suddenly discovered to be naked. And you feel, look, you know, one can never be entirely sure of these things. You can check and check and check and check, but you're never sure. By now, other people have done similar experiments and found similar things. So we're confident this is, first of all, a good method, and second of all, an accurate result. But the first time you make a discovery of this kind, you inevitably feel pretty uncertain about the whole thing. You're probably the person in the room when you're speaking who knows most about where it might be wrong. At least if you are, that's a good position to be in. And so you're constantly thinking, well, could this be wrong? Could that be wrong? But fortunately, it turned out to be a good result.
Yeah, exactly. It's when you have this kind of new methodology coming, you know, to the scientific market, we can say, and then it's like you can have the whole imposter syndrome sometimes. You know, this kind of uncertainty, like this is true, I don't know, I am myself. And this is the first time, yes. You know?
Yes. Well, of course, what I always realize is that the edifice that you're working within, you know, the theoretical framework, has been developed by some people who are very smart, right? So, you know, that's where the imposter syndrome comes from. I couldn't possibly rank myself alongside of these people. So therefore, there must be something wrong with what I've done. But actually, in this case, that's not as, you know, that's not such a bad approach. You've got to keep checking everything without becoming obsessed by it. But you do have to do systematic checks.
And now, what are your main research areas? So fast forward, you know, many years after.
Yeah. Okay, well, I started off in galaxy dynamics. So that was in my PhD thesis. So that is the internal motions of gas and stars in galaxies used to determine such things as whether they reside in dark halos, whether they contain a central black hole mass, how big that mass would be, and so on. And then I moved into this area of mapping cosmology, and I kept going, working in that sort of area, doing one or two further surveys after the Great Attractor discovery. But I have actually returned in the last 20 years to my original work on galaxy dynamics. And we built, a group of three of us built an instrument for the William Herschel telescope called Sauron. And we used that instrument to make some dynamical maps, a few hundred galaxies, in order to understand those galaxies better. And the thing that I've developed to go along in parallel with the dynamical analysis is an analysis of what kind of stars are present, how old are they, what's their chemical composition, and how, therefore, were they assembled, and how do they relate to each other, one kind of galaxy and another. So I've added, this is called the study of stellar populations. So I've added the study of stellar populations to the study of the dynamics of galaxies. And that's what I spend my time doing now.
If you want to be part of the European space innovation ecosystem in a digital format, go to our website to read more information about how to join. www.eurospacehub.com.
Why the space missions are so important? You know, because we met in the European Parliament talking about this topic.
Okay, so space missions and ground-based telescopes are complementary in the data that they provide us with. I mean, clearly, most electromagnetic radiation doesn't make it to the surface of the Earth, thank goodness. So if you want to study the universe in the wavelengths that don't make it to the surface of the Earth, so that's everything but optical and radio, basically, then you need a spacecraft, right? So that's the first reason, get above the atmosphere, be able to look at X-rays, ultraviolet, far infrared, and so on, gamma rays, everything. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that we sit below, at least if we sit in Oxford today, a rather soggy blanket of cloud and murk. And even on the best astronomical sites, where there isn't cloud and murk, there is nevertheless motions in the Earth's atmosphere, which are convections, essentially. And so different cells of the Earth's atmosphere, about 10, 20 centimeters across, have different, slightly different temperatures and densities. And you can think of this as an array of cells that are sort of bubbling like a boiling kettle. If you look into a boiling kettle, you see this effect. And of course, because the air cells have a different temperature and density, they do actually refract the light from the stars. So here's this light that spent hundreds, thousands, millions of light years reaching to us, and it's a pristine wavefront when it hits the top of the Earth's atmosphere, absolutely perfect plane wavefront. But unfortunately, the Earth's atmosphere, because it's inhomogeneous in density, introduces quite substantial corrugations into that beautiful plane wavefront, and that causes the images that our telescopes on the ground make to be blurred. And astronomers call this seeing. There's a much more romantic name for it, which is twinkling. So every child knows the nursery rhyme, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And it's a lovely nursery rhyme, but it's pretty awful news for astronomers. And so the twinkling of stars causes ground-based images to be blurred. And if you're above the atmosphere, you can eliminate that effect. So you get pristine, sharp images, images as sharp as the diffraction of your optical system will allow. And that's very, very much sharper than images made from the ground. There's a little additional piece of information to do with this, which has been available for the last 30 years. So at the end of the Cold War, the United States declassified its image sharpening technology. And astronomers adopted that. It's called adaptive optics, and made it work for astronomy. What the US military had wouldn't particularly work very well for astronomy. And that technology, known as adaptive optics, has allowed us to take space quality images, space resolution images from the ground. The initial challenge was this could only be done at reasonably far red and infrared wavelengths and over very small fields of view. But the wavelength that you can do it down to now is kind of in the middle of the optical. It's still not to the blue and ultraviolet, but to the middle of the optical. And over now, much wider field of view. And this involves a technology of launching laser guide stars. So it's very complicated technology. However, it does work pretty well. So one of the advantages of going to space has a bit been taken over by advances of technology on the ground.
But space is not only a space, aeronautics, astrophysics, astronautics, has a lot of disciplines to make everything happen. If you have in the top of your mind, how many different disciplines are involved in one mission?
Well, it's an enormous number. So, I mean, spacecraft are launched by agencies that have huge teams behind them. So the first part is you've got to be able to launch your spacecraft, and you're already launching anything. You need a huge team of people who are electronic engineers, mechanical engineers, thermal analysis specialists, mechanical analysis specialists. You rock the spacecraft very violently to see how it's going to behave when it's launched. You've got to have systems engineers. You have to have project managers. You have to have the whole panoply of support services that you need when anybody is doing a big project. So, you know, you need HR, you need leaders and so on. So you need project scientists, project managers, and a whole team of people to back up the launch. And you need all those people as well for your satellite. And so it is a huge interdisciplinary team. You need more specialist team members for the satellite itself. And so you need people who are specialized in optics, people who are specialized in detectors, vibration analysis, electronic isolation, cryogenics, power, providing power for the spacecraft. So there's a huge range of disciplines needed. And so that's a major challenge, getting everybody's discipline to work together to produce a fine end product.
Professor Davis, you have an important role in the European Astronomical Society. So what is the main objective of the EAS? And what do you think are the main needs and issues for the astrophysics research?
So the main aim of the European Astronomical Society is to promote astronomy in Europe. That's simply stated. At all levels, right? So we are a professional society, a society of professionals. But of course, we span the whole range of activity from supporting people who want to report their results, because we have a big annual meeting. That's probably our largest activity. We attract a couple of thousand people now to our annual meetings. There are lots of talks, lots of posters. We're able to have panel discussions on issues of the moment. So, for example, one at the moment is the question of satellite constellations and how they are going to affect astronomy in the future. But lots of different areas, women in astronomy. We have sessions on African astronomy. So a whole range of things in the annual meeting. Then we have some working groups that work on other areas. So I've already mentioned the satellite constellations. We call that our Dark and Quiet Skies working group. We have a working group on diversity. We have a working group on sustainability. So we have a lot of people who help us to drive forward the agendas in those areas in the annual meetings and more broadly. But our main role is to promote European astronomy, right from students to professors, but also even outreach and using our influence to look into the ways in which astronomy can be used to bring young people into science generally. Astronomy is a very accessible science, much more accessible than most physical sciences. And therefore, we can draw students in through our outreach programs providing some resources for that. There is an office, a European office of astronomy for development, based, which the society co-sponsors with the University of Leiden. And that looks for ways in which astronomy can be used to promote the development, so the development of society generally. In Europe, that means working with refugee communities, with underserved communities, and so on. So we try and take a very broad view of our role and promote European astronomy across society.
And this is very important, the part of the outreach. As well, there is this factor of coming from the university as a knowledge transfer, technology transfer into society transfer. Could be done at the school level, but I mean, as well with industry.
Yeah.
Why this is so important?
Well, I think it's very clear to me from my own career that advances in astronomy are often driven by advances in technology. And I've mentioned one of them already, right? Adaptive optics and so on. I mean, space missions are another example. So when I started as an astronomer in the late 70s, I actually did take some photographic plates, right? Now, so photographic plates have a quantum efficiency of about 1% if you're very lucky, right? So they detect 1% of the light that's incident on them. Whereas these days, the solid state detectors charge a couple of devices, and the infrared detectors, they will detect over 90% of the light incident on them. So immediately you have a huge improvement in what you can do with a piece of, with a telescope or a piece of equipment just by changing the detector. Similarly, we are now able to make much more sophisticated instruments because complex optical surfaces can be milled and polished. And so there's a whole range of areas of technology that have advanced, which can be applied directly to improving astronomical measurements. And that, of course, is one way of advancing the subject.
So the European Astronomical Society, or Astrophysics High, as well, is a very highly collaborative research community. And what do other research infrastructures can learn from you? And what are the main values? How you organize all this research versus society?
Well, I wouldn't want to suggest that astronomy is somehow better than other disciplines in planning and so on. But one aspect of astronomy is that it's a small part of physics, and it's a small part of physics which is global in its scope. So no country has more than a few thousand astronomers. I mean, you know, most countries only have a few tens of astronomers, a few hundreds of astronomers. And so astronomical research tends to be very international. And this doesn't set it aside from other fields of physics, but because we need very large infrastructures, in particular space missions and large ground-based telescopes, which typically cost hundreds of millions or billions of euros, we need to work together to plan and to convince governments and agencies that they should invest in what really are very expensive infrastructures. And a really important aspect of doing that successfully is to show that we have planned carefully and that we have come to agreement across the international community, or at least across some big parts of it, that this is the right thing to do, that this is the small number of projects which we want to take forward in this decade, and we're not just going to ask for everything. We're going to prioritize. And so the United States has been doing that kind of exercise for a long time. They call it the decadal review. Europe started doing it maybe 20, 30 years ago. And so we also now plan rather carefully what our priorities are. And of course, they're not identical to the priorities elsewhere, but they are similar. And we often find ourselves collaborating with North American astronomers, Japanese astronomers, Chinese astronomers, the big communities. And this is one way in which we can hope to convince the people who have to pay for these missions, basically the taxpayers, this is an exciting thing and it is important, and that we're all behind it. The last thing people who are contemplating paying for these activities want to see is people from a discipline arguing with each other about what they believe is important. And so perhaps if I was to suggest that astronomers do something perhaps well, I'd say it's that we plan well and find consensus in the way forward and put these priorities to our funders so they have a clear view of what we think are the most important projects and how we want to go about doing them.
If you want to be part of the European space innovation ecosystem in a digital format, go to our website to read more information about how to join. www.eurospacehub.com.
And now we are talking about Eurospace Hub, like wants to facilitate collaboration among different research space communities, not only astronomy, astrophysics. What does it mean for you and for your work and for your society, this Eurospace Hub?
So I think all these aspects that promote collaboration, particularly collaboration across disciplines within, say, space science or within astronomy, are a way of achieving this communication, which is essential for planning. So there are always people who have had a go at doing something that you're thinking of trying to do. And it's not always obvious where to find them. And so facilities like Eurospace Hub can put people together who perhaps have a common goal. Some will have gone a little bit further along the path than others and can perhaps help people to avoid pitfalls and provide some insight into how to advance a particular area. It's, as we mentioned earlier, there's a wide range of specializations involved in space science and astronomy, and it's not straightforward to bring those interdisciplinary aspects together. And so a tool that allows us to do this can be very important.
And now, because we are talking always about innovation, Professor, this is the basic but super difficult question to answer always for our guest speakers. What does mean innovation for you?
Innovation. Well, I think it's, in many ways, innovation is a bit of a feeling, right? I mean, innovation, of course, means that you're trying to do something that hasn't been done before. You want to take a different approach. And that's very like the research I was describing, right? You're bound to have a little bit of a feeling of, well, is it going to work? You know, and you never know, do you? You never know till you get there. So innovation is something that requires imagination. It requires curiosity. It requires resilience, because innovation doesn't happen like that. It takes a number of goes, and it takes adaptability. So you've got to be able to bring together a range of skills, a range of people to a problem, to find new ways of addressing a challenge. And so I think innovation is absolutely crucial to advance science. And I tend to feel that, you know, if you don't have the feeling that, well, you know, is it going to work? Have I really understood this? You know, then it's not innovation. You know, it's just something you've done before, right? So that's one of the things I'd say is what innovation means to me.
Impressive. So that's why you are a professor in astrophysics in Oxford. So, and the other way around of the question is, what does it mean for you then, collaboration for innovation?
Okay, so collaboration for innovation is essential, because one of the ways in which you create that spark of an idea is you get different people with a different background, to look at the same problem. And they don't always see the same problem. They see something different. And so if you can get them to tell you what they see and vice versa, you can find perhaps ways in which each of you can contribute to a new approach to a difficult problem. I think there are many examples of this, but I think, you know, without cooperation between people, without collaboration, then innovation is going to be really difficult. Although there is this romantic notion that a scientist sits at their desk and comes up with a bright idea, you know, the idea of a scientist with a light bulb over their head. And this is a wonderful idea, but it's largely a fictional idea. And most of these innovations require a bit of that indeed, but an awful lot of hard work and in the library and on the internet and talking in meetings and finding the right way forward and hiring the right people and getting the right kit and the right place at the right time. You know, it's hard work is what it is. And bringing people together to collaborate is itself quite difficult because people don't always speak the same technical language. They have to explain to each other what they mean and what they see the limitations being and so on. So, yeah, it's maybe 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration, as they say.
Very good. Now, Professor David, we have always, at the end of the podcast, super quick questions about you. So are you ready?
Yes, go ahead.
What does your morning's routine look like?
Oh, well, morning. I like mornings. And so my morning, it's a couple of cups of tea, a cup of coffee. I usually make porridge for breakfast and then I walk the dog, right? So that's my morning and I like walking the dog in the morning. And so, you know, that gives you a clear mind at the start of the day.
What is your favorite place for holidays?
Favorite place for holidays? Well, I like to hike and I like the coast. So, and I like whiskey. So I like to go to the far north of Scotland. The very far north, so much further north than most people go. My favorite place in the far northwest of Scotland is a place called Loch Inver, which is a very beautiful place with what in Britain we call mountains, but really are only hills. But nevertheless, there are some tough climbs, you know, beautiful hikes, great beaches, but rather cold sea. So you don't really go swimming up there. But it's a beautiful part of the United Kingdom. And my wife and I have been going with our various dogs for many years.
So what are you doing with your spare time and your weekends?
I guess partly the same, going for walks and walking the dog and so on. But the other thing I like to do when I have a spare moment is I like to work in my garden. I don't have a huge garden, but strangely, perhaps I've always enjoyed growing roses. And so I have quite a lot of roses in my garden. Roses can be a bit challenging at times. You have to cherish them and care for them, but they are beautiful, beautiful things. And so I like to work in the garden. I'm looking out the window and I'm glancing this way. It's raining now, so I couldn't possibly be doing that now. But yeah, and in England, of course, we do get quite a lot of rain and some sunshine, and it's hopefully hasn't been too hot or too cold. So it's very good for gardens. England has wonderful gardens.
That is true. So you have green fingers, like they say.
well, perhaps on one hand.
If you would like to recommend a book or a piece of music?
Yeah, a piece of music. Okay, so I have very Catholic taste in music. So, you know, if you ask me to recommend a piece of rock music, I just still enjoy Layla by Eric Clapton. I think that's a fantastic piece of music. And then I also, you know, really enjoy listening to classical music. Sometimes go to the concert hall and enjoy that. So, you know, the Beethoven symphonies, the Ninth Symphony, the Choral Symphony is just absolutely breathtaking. It's wonderful to see in person. At this time of year, it's just before Easter, we're making this recording, the St. Matthew Passion is a wonderfully calming and spiritual piece of music. So a range of bits of music there. So I'm going to pause now because I saw the book question and I have several books that I could recommend, but I'm trying to think of which one I should. Well, I know. Yes, I know what to do. So for a book, I like to read whodunits. My favorite author until she died was P.D. James. with her detective, Adam Dalgliesh. So any of her books, I have enjoyed reading.
Thank you very much, Professor Roger Davis, for this fantastic conversation and to share all your knowledge to inspire other professionals to become astronomers, to become passionate about astronomy, and to understand what does it mean for all of us.
Good. I'm delighted to have been able to participate, and good luck with your enterprise.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to our Eurospace Hub special episode from the podcast Business of Collaboration. Please share this podcast with your space friends and leave comments on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or on Stitcher. See you next month for another story and interview. In the meantime, you can learn more about us on www.eurospacehub.com.